This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I'm not much of a cook, but I love talking about food with Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of the public TV series America's Test Kitchen. When they talk about preparing food, they're really good at explaining why the recipe works. Bishop is the editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. Lancaster is the lead instructor of its cooking school. They've contributed to the America's Test Kitchen DIY Do-It-Yourself Cookbook. Today, they're going to answer questions from the Fresh Air staff about grilling, handling raw meat safely, making some unusual salads, and more. Bridget Lancaster, Jack Bishop, welcome back to Fresh Air. This morning, while I was preparing my interview with you, I thought I would ask everybody who works on Fresh Air if they had any questions they wanted me to ask you about issues they've been having with food preparation. And so I have some for you, and I'd love to hear what your answers are. And I know everyone who works on Fresh Air would love to hear it too, and I'm sure our listeners will as well, because they're probably having some of these same issues. Let's start with something really basic. Hamburgers. Lots of people are grilling them for the summer. And both Sam Brigger and John Myers of our show want to know, like, to make a really good hamburger on a grill, like, how thick should you make it? Like, what should the size of the patty be? And how do you know when they're done? Because it's so easy for it to be rare in the middle or just to accidentally overcook it.
Well, a couple of things. I think that if you're going to be grilling the hamburger, one of the reasons you want to be grilling it is to get that great crust on the outside. And in order to give the grill enough time to put a crust on it, it's going to have to be a fairly thick patty. You know, if you're starting with a really thin patty, it's going to be overcooked by the time it gets well browned on the outside. So make it fairly thick. Another thing that you want to, and fairly thick means probably, I don't know, Bridget, I would say 3/4 of an inch to an inch
that
thick.
That sounds about right.
Seems about right. One of the tricks we found is
Do you thin it toward the edge or keep it that way all the way through?
No, you're going to put a divot in the center, Terry, because what happens is that when the burger is on the grill, the muscle fibers shrink and what is a flat patty turns into a tennis ball. And you get this sort of rounded burger that then is very difficult to put toppings on or put on a bun. And so the way to prevent that is to anticipate the rounding and to put a divot in the top of it. So that means simply going around and pressing about a half inch depression in this sort of center half of the top of the burger. And that will naturally puff up on the grill and it will puff up and therefore be flat. So those are a couple things. The other big thing is that, you know, there's a lot of fat in a burger, but they still can stick to the grill. And so preparing the grill properly so that you're able to flip it without losing portions of the burger is really important. And it's really simple trick is to take a wad of paper towels that you dip in vegetable oil, hold them with a pair of tongs, and use those to grease the grate right before you put the burgers on. It's even better with fish, which is always sticking, is to oil those grates. And you don't want to be spraying things because that can be really dangerous. I've seen people spray, you know, use cooking spray outdoors. You do not want to be doing that because you can, you know, get the aerosol to ignite. So you just simply take the wad of paper towels, hold them with the long handled tongs. They're dipped in oil, and then just rub them right back and forth where you're going to cook.
Oh, that sounds good. And you weren't kidding about the divot.
I was not kidding about the divot.
Okay, now speaking of flipping, this is a question from John Sheehan from Fresh Air. Since, you know, bacteria are such an issue when you're working with raw chicken, so, you know, and you don't want to contaminate any surfaces or any cooking utensils with bacteria. So if you're cooking with, you know, a spatula or tongs, what do you do to make sure that you're not contaminating those utensils with bacteria by touching them to the chicken before the chicken's cooked and the bacteria are killed?
This is a great question. I've been asked this before, too. So officially, I'm going to tell you that every time your utensils touch the raw food, that you should either clean them or have a few pairs of tongs available. And actually, if people knew how we set up our stations at the test kitchen, the test cooks will get a big container and they gather all their tools there. And then they have these kitchen crocks, and each of these containers maybe has 4 or 5 different pairs of tongs. And we use a lot of raw food, a lot of raw meat. So contamination is definitely a concern. For myself, you know, if you're flipping over chicken, I would rinse it under hot water or, you know, quickly wash it off. If I'm out on the grill, the trick that I use is I will stick the tongs through the grill grates quickly over the charcoal so that basically the it's incinerating any bacteria that might be on the actual tongs. But Jack, I don't know what you do.
Well, I think the biggest concern is that last time you touched the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first 10 times that you're touching the chicken isn't really...
It's still raw.
It's still raw or it's still not cooked. But when you're going to take the chicken off of the grill and onto a platter, I want to use a clean pair of tongs and I want to put it on a clean platter.
Right.
You know, the platter that you use to bring the food out to the grill is not the platter that should be bringing the food back indoors.
Absolutely.
Because there's, and people don't think about that. And so I will always have a clean platter and a clean pair of tongs for that last transfer of the cooked food onto a clean platter. I'm less concerned about cross-contamination while it's still cooking because, you know, the bacteria is right on the exterior, which is going to get hot, and 5 seconds later, that bacteria is going to be cooked off.
That sounds like really good advice. Our next food question comes from Phyllis Myers of Fresh Air, and she just had, I think at a friend's house, a kale salad that was massaged with salt. And it sounded to me like a massage therapist had come in and kind of given a treatment to the salad. But I've never heard this before. I am told that kale salad is really popular right now. So I know kale can be a little bit tough. What kind of tips do you have for a good kale salad?
Believe it or not, we tested the massage theory in the kitchen and it works.
Oh.
Phyllis is on to something. You do want to start out with young, tender leaves. I mean, at certain times of the year, especially in the winter, you can get kale that's been out in the field, gone through a couple of frosts, and is just big and hearty. And you could massage that for several days and you're not going to want to eat it raw. It's really meant for cooking. So the first thing is to shop properly if you really want to have a kale salad. I actually think the Italian variety of kale, they sometimes call it dinosaur kale, La Cinto kale, see different names, but it's got a kind of mottled dark green surface. It's a little bit bumpy, and I just think it has a nice flavor. It makes a better salad. So small leaves, and you are massaging them in the bowl for about 5 minutes. Now, that seems like a lot of work, actually, for a salad. I'm not sure I'm going to make kale salad and massage it for my guests.
How do you massage kale? I don't even get it. What are you doing?
You are basically putting the kale in the bowl and with your hands just rubbing it. And I guess what you're doing, I'm going to sound very sciencey here, is that you're breaking down the cellular structure very gently. You're not trying to mash it or mangle it, but you are making the leaves a little bit more tender. The outside of the leaves can be a little rough, and I think you're basically kind of using your hands as emery boards.
Exfoliating.
You're exfoliating the kale. So that it seems a little bit more tender when you go to use it in a salad.
And it definitely preserves its fresh flavor. So you're not cooking the kale in order to soften it. So you definitely get a fresher flavor. But if the kale was under some stress and needed a massage, you probably do by the end of it after massaging the kale.
Okay. So this next question about food comes from Danny Miller. And he wants to know, like, when you're grilling eggplant, should you salt it first to draw out the moisture? And he asked this in part because he tends to do that, and Danny's wife, Mary, goes with, that's just a myth, and Danny goes with the salt. So you could see there's possibilities here for really serious marital conflict over this.
The eggplant years.
Yes, exactly.
I would say, well, it depends on the two things, the eggplant and how thick you're slicing the eggplant. One of the great things about the grill is that it lets any kind of moisture wick away. So if you have thinly sliced eggplant, just say your regular purple eggplant, you thinly slice it, brush it with a little bit of oil, it's going to go on and off the grill very quickly. It's probably not going to be an issue. However, if you're going to slice it a little bit thicker or into thicker planks, I would still salt it. I would salt it, leave it be, and then What we like to do in the test kitchen is press the eggplant as well. So after you've salted it, you can put it in between some towels or paper towels and gently press on it. And that compacts its structure a little bit, makes it meatier, and it makes it so that it doesn't get mushy on the grill. And then a little bit of olive oil, some herbs over a hot fire, and very quickly on and off.
So the answer is yes, if. Yes, salted, if it's cut thick.
I would say yes, unless he wants to save his marriage. And then I would go with his wife's opinion.
No, but it sounds like this is a, you know, if it's sliced thin, then you don't really need the salt.
Sliced thin, so. You don't really need to. So, but I actually like to salt everything before it goes on the grill anyway, just for flavor. So, you know, a good 10 minutes with salt on it isn't going to hurt anybody. That's the happy medium for them. They can meet in the middle.
Here's a question from Teresa Madden of our show. She has a lot of zucchini from her CSA, the community-supported agriculture community farm that she buys her produce from. And she doesn't have a grill, and she doesn't have good air conditioning, or maybe any air conditioning. So she can't grill, and she doesn't really want to cook on hot days in the summer. So what can she do with the zucchini that's left over?
I have a revelation. If you've never had a raw zucchini salad, now this is a good use for small to medium zucchini. You know, if you're getting 2 pound zucchini that are kind of watery and full of seeds, I'm not sure I would use this recipe for it. But if you've got 6 or 8 ounce, you know, what I would call medium or small zucchini, slice them really thin. You know, if you have a mandolin, you can get an inexpensive plastic mandolin at any houseware store. And you're basically just slicing it as thin as you can. If you've got a great sharp knife, you can use a knife as well. But at least, you know, an eighth of an inch, better at a 16th of an inch thick. I like to slice it on the bias so that I get sort of longer pieces of the zucchini. You can do it with the golden zucchini. You can do it with summer squash. I put them on a platter. I will then shave Parmesan cheese, throw some fresh herbs, basil, mint, chives, drizzle it with the best extra virgin olive oil you have, salt and pepper, and it is the perfect first course raw zucchini salad that is a great way to start any summer meal.
Is there anything in it besides the zucchini?
It is zucchini. I like to put the Parmesan and the herbs, but you could really be as simple as zucchini, salt, pepper, and olive oil.
But I mean, no other vegetables or no grains or anything, just the zucchini.
Just the zucchini. Well, you asked for ways to use a lot of zucchini.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And this is not, you know, one of those recipes where you use one zucchini. You're going to need a couple of pounds of zucchini. If you're making this salad for, let's say, 6 people, you're probably going to want, you know, 2 pounds of zucchini. That's why the mandolin can go really quickly. Unless you've got good knife skills, it can be a lot of slicing. And it really depends on getting paper-thin slices of the zucchini that are just really great raw, and it doesn't heat up the kitchen. You really sort of get a different textural experience of the zucchini. You know, it's not that soft, kind of mushy zucchini that often happens when you saute it. And it's just a great canvas for, you know, salt, pepper, olive oil, Parmesan, and herbs.
Well, poof, you've solved the extra zucchini problem. Okay, from Roberta Shirock of our show, the question is, so how long can you keep out potato salad, like if you're at a picnic or something?
Potato salad. I believe potato salad, the enemy in there is the potato, not the actual mayonnaise.
Really? I thought it was the mayonnaise.
Well, store-bought mayonnaise, this is very different from homemade mayonnaise, but store-bought mayonnaise has so many preservatives in it. Now, I'm not saying to put it in the back window of your car and drive around and leave it. But potato salad, what happens... I'm not exact, Jack. I can't actually remember what happens with the potato.
Bridget is right. The potato is the problem, that there is naturally occurring bacteria. And the rules are really pretty simple. It's, 2 hours at a picnic, unless it's really hot and really sunny, and really hot means above 90 degrees, and then you've got an hour that it should be out of refrigeration. Otherwise, potato salad needs to be, at 34, 35 degrees in the refrigerator. The source of the problem begins with the potatoes, and then the mayonnaise is simply the mechanism that allows the nasty bugs to grow. And so the mayonnaise is a little guilty, but really
the carrier.
Yes. So really, on a hot day, an hour is really all anything really should stay out on the picnic table that's a raw food like that or cooked foods, that it can really be a breeding ground for trouble.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of the public television shows America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. They've also contributed to the new America's Test Kitchen cookbook, DIY cookbook, the do-it-yourself cookbook. And I am now asking them questions that come from the Fresh Air staff about issues they're having with cooking. So this comes from Lauren Krenzel of our show. What are the best fishes to grill?
When you're choosing fish to grill, two things you want to think about. Is it sturdy? You know, if it's one of those flaky fish, I see people trying to grill cod or, you know,
flounder.
That's just, you're headed for trouble. So you want a meaty fish that stays together when it's cooked. And if it's a fish that flakes apart very easily, it really belongs indoors, you know, in a skillet, in the oven, something like that. Second thing is thicker is better. That really thin pieces of fish are hard to grill, in part because you can leave them on the grill longer before you have to turn them without overcooking them. And the longer you can leave it on the grill, the more of a crust you're going to get on the fish and the less likely that it's going to fall apart when you go to flip it or take it off the grill. And so salmon is great. Tuna's
great. It's made for the grill.
Yeah. Swordfish. You know, they're all halibut.
Halibut steaks, yeah.
They're all meaty. They're all about an inch thick, which helps. Most of those that I just named have a fair amount of fat in them. Not the tuna, but especially the salmon, which helps, you know, prevent sticking and works nicely on the grill.
This question comes from Heidi Simon. And it's actually from her husband, Joel, who does a lot of cooking. And he's been heading in a more vegan direction and wants to know your suggestions for how to grill and marinate tofu.
It's a sponge. You know, tofu is a lot like eggplant. And that's a good thing in the sense that it is a blank canvas that will soak up whatever flavors that you want to give it. Unlike meat, where marinating can sometimes take a fair amount of time, tofu, 20 minutes is going to be enough. And so basically marinate it as long as it takes for you to get the grill going. I think the best way to do it, don't bother trying to cut it into cubes or skewer it, is simply to take extra firm tofu. Don't try to do the soft tofu. Cut it in, crosswise into 8 slabs. So if you have that package, it's either 14 or 16 ounces. You're basically cutting it into little rectangular cutlets that are each maybe 3/4 inch thick. And you've taken, you know, that one block, cut it into 8 pieces. Put them in a baking dish. Any marinade that you like. Soy always makes sense with tofu. The salt makes most things taste better. Add something a little bit of sweet, maybe a little hoisin or oyster sauce. Add a little bit of oil, some vegetable oil so that it won't stick. You can add some spices, 5 spice powder, chipotle chilies. I mean, you want to use the strong flavors with the tofu because the reverse of it being a blank canvas is it can be very boring. And so if you don't use strong flavors in the marinade, it will be a little bit boring. This is a good time to use the oiled paper towel to oil down that grill grate because the tofu can stick. So you take the water paper towels with the oil and hold them with the tongs and rub that back and forth. Grill them just until they're lightly charred on each side. And, you know, it's a really great way to make a quick vegan summer grill entree.
Do you eat grilled tofu yourself?
I do. I love tofu. We probably have tofu once a week in my house. I either grill it or I pan sear it. And I would say most of the year I'm pan searing it, but then adding a lot of flavors to it for just that reason. My kids love it with sesame and scallions and ginger and soy sauce. And, you know, you can serve it with rice and vegetables, and it's a great meal.
Here's a question from Molly C.V. Nesper of our show. What do you think about grilling fruit? And if you like that idea, which fruits and how to do it?
I wouldn't say that I am in the I like grilling all fruit camp. I love fresh fruit uncooked as much as possible. However, grilled pineapple is one of my very favorite things. It has so much natural sugar in it. Or there's other fruits, mango. Some people like to do kebabs of berries. I'm not too into that, but you just brush it with a little bit of an oil that's very neutral in flavor. So something a little bit like a vegetable oil, just very lightly, or you can even spray it with vegetable oil spray and quickly over the fire. You're just really searing it. You're not trying to cook it all the way through because it's raw fruit. But To me, pineapple and the grill is a magic combination because it caramelizes the sugars. It concentrates that pineapple flavor, and it's absolutely delicious.
Jack, any thoughts?
The two fruits that I grill are lemons and peaches. And the lemons, I will actually cut them into, with the skin still on, kind of 1-inch pieces, and put them on kebabs. And, you know, sort of alternate that with chicken. I think it's really particularly good with chicken and the vegetables. And grilled lemons, they get kind of sweet and charred. They add some juiciness, some flavor. And so if you, it's an interesting way to grill the fruit is to cut it kind of the way you would cut eggplant or zucchini, but put some lemons on. Now, you don't want to go overboard. You know, 2 lemon pieces, maybe 3 per skewer is fine. I'm not sure you want a skewer that has 10 pieces of lemon on it. The other one is peaches, and I will have
Wait, let me just stop you. Do you actually eat the lemon, or is that just for flavoring?
No, I eat the lemon. Mm-hmm. I eat the skin and all. I mean, you want to wash the, you want to wash it well, so you don't know if there's any wax on it to get rid of that. So wash it under some hot water and scrub it with a little vegetable brush, so it's nice and clean. And obviously, the lemons that don't have a stamp on them, you know, it's not very attractive if it has a label on it that's been stamped. So if you're going to be eating it, check that at the supermarket and try to get one of the organic lemons that hasn't been stamped with a brand name on it. And certainly if it's got a peel-off sticker, make sure to peel off the sticker. But yeah, it's a really interesting way to eat them. And that's why I said you're not going to want to eat a lot of those pieces, but you put a couple of those on. It could be good with fish, swordfish in particular. But I do it a lot with chicken, and no one's ever had it. When they're at my house, they're like, really? You eat the lemon? And I was like, try it. And everyone's convinced once they eat the lemon.
It definitely tempers the acidity, too. Yeah. Okay. A little bit of cooking.
And what about the peaches, the grilled peaches?
The peaches, I have and pit them, brush them lightly with oil. And I think grilled peaches and pork is a natural combination. The only trick is you want to get ripe but still firm peaches. You know, if it's a peach that's so ripe that it's going to run down your chin and neck as you're eating it, you're going to have a little bit of trouble probably with it on the grill. You don't want to use the rock hard, awful tasting peaches, but you want to catch it right before it's soft. But when it's ripe, cut it in half, brush it with oil, and it's just a great accompaniment to pork chops, a pork roast on the grill.
Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster are with the public TV shows America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. They've contributed to the America's Test Kitchen DIY Do-It-Yourself Cookbook. You'll find a longer version of my interview with them on our website, freshair.npr.org. When he was just out of college, director Destin Daniel Cretton took a job at a Southern California short-term care facility for at-risk teenagers. His time there became the basis for a feature-length movie called Short Term 12, starring Brie Larson and John Gallagher Jr. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It's easy to make fun of a certain kind of therapeutic language, the kind you hear all through the movie Short Term 12. That title comes from the name of a group home for abused and/or unstable teens. Early on, a young counselor named Grace, played by Brie Larson, tells one smart-mouthed kid that, quote, your attitude is not helping either one of us, which would tend to make her a repressive drag in a typical Hollywood teen picture. But Grace is among the film's most tortured figures. She proves therapy speak doesn't have to be clueless or mechanical. It can be profoundly empathetic, and it can also heal the would-be healer. Every day, Grace rides to work on a bicycle, and the moment she enters the squat facility, she begins a series of fraught negotiations with her charges. At times, those dealings suggest documentary realism. It's no surprise that writer-director Destin Daniel Cretton worked for 2 years in a short-term center. What is a surprise is that the only character he condescends to is the one based on him, a glib newbie named Nate, played by Rami Malek. I suspect Cretton is being hard on himself. On the basis of the movie, he seems to have, like Grace, a capacity for empathy that's limitless. There's so much free-floating pain in Short Term 12 that the handheld camera's jitters seem unusually organic. We don't see the abusers, only the consequences of abuse. One of the smaller kids, Sammy, played by Alex Calloway, plays with dolls that an outside therapist decides to take away, leaving him barely reachable. Keith Stanfield plays Marcus, a 17-year-old African-American who keeps his eyes down but has a keen awareness of slights. He's about to turn 18 and graduate into the real world, a prospect that fills him with dread. A new arrival is Jaden, a punky upper-middle-class girl played by Caitlin Dever. Grace introduces her at their community meeting to Marcus, little Sammy, and the others.
Okay, everyone. I think most of you have already met her, but we have a new member of our community. Jaden, would you introduce yourself?
Please don't be offended if I'm not very friendly, but I'm going to be living with my dad soon, and I don't really like wasting time on short-term relationships, so, you know, it's nothing personal.
Wow. She seems like a really nice girl.
Hey, I think we all can respect her space, okay?
Okay, what do we want to play for rec today?
Wiffle ball, dude.
Okay.
Oh, man. We're always playing that stupid game.
Because you always suck at it. Until you get good at it, maybe we can stop playing it.
Watch your mouth, bro.
Both of you, cut it out. Any other suggestions? Yes, Sammy?
Can we play big and small?
Is that a real game or is that a game you just made up?
It's a real game that I just made up.
Okay. Well, maybe you can explain that to me later.
Jaden is very funny and an amazing artist, but her rage when it comes is demonic in its intensity, like something out of The Exorcist. She reads to Grace an original story about an octopus who's friends with a shark that has haunted my dreams. So has the rap song by Marcus, a series of horrific accusations against his mother that builds to a stinging lament for, quote, a life not knowing what a normal life's like. You don't catch Keith's Stanfield or Caitlin Dever acting. They seem to be living this. Brie Larson gives a breakout performance in Short Term 12. I didn't recognize her from her role as the savvy ex-girlfriend in The Spectacular Now. Her transparency made me forget that she's ever done anything else on screen. There's no residue of other roles. Grace has been a victim herself, and it's dismaying to watch her hold and talk her charges down and then act out at home with her boyfriend, another counselor named Mason, played by John Gallagher Jr. from The Newsroom. Gallagher's gentle, self-effacing performance is as finely wrought in its way as Larson's. Director Destin Daniel Cretton has a clear design in Short Term 12. Grace and Mason will have a breakthrough with a kid and will think, that's it, he or she is over the hump. Then the kid will have another outburst, a tantrum, say, or a bout of self-cutting, and the process will begin again. One step forward, one fall back. There's no cure, only the hope that something will get through a kid's defenses. The mood is fraught, the equilibrium fragile. The score, by Joel P. West, so gentle, it's as if the composer doesn't want to bruise the characters. It sweetens what we see without falsifying it. Short Term 12 leaves you shaken, but not hopeless. It suggests that a certain kind of love, however short-term, can be everlasting.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Short Term 12, starring Brie Larson and John Gallagher Jr. We're going to listen to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Mexican actor Damian Bichir, who co-stars in the FX series The Bridge, a murder mystery set on the Texas-Mexico border. Bichir has had a successful career acting in Mexico, but he's leaving his mark on Hollywood as well. He played Fidel Castro in the Steven Soderbergh film Che, and he had a recurring role as a drug kingpin and politician in the Showtime series Weeds. 2 years ago, Bichir earned an Oscar nomination for Best Actor for his performance in the Chris Weitz film A Better Life. The series The Bridge begins with the discovery of a body on the bridge connecting El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico. Bichir plays a Mexican detective who has to work with an El Paso homicide cop, played by Diane Kruger, on what turns out to be a serial murder case. The relationship is complicated by the fact that Kruger's character, Detective Sonia Woods, has Asperger's.
In this scene, she and Bachir's character, Detective Marco Ruiz, are driving in a truck, and Woods speaks to Ruiz in her typically blunt way.
They say you all corrupt. Mexican police, you all take bribes?
Not all of us. The cartels threaten everyone, and sometimes for some people, it's a lot easier to just look the other way, for a price, of course.
They give you money so you won't do the police work?
Not exactly. They tell you plata o plomo. Take our silver, or take our lead.
So you just let the girls die?
I do the best I can. The situation is... it's un desmadre.
You should try harder.
Of course I should.
And that's our guest, Damian Bachir, with Diane Kruger in their new series, The Bridge. Damian Bachir, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
You know, this drama is set on the border between El Paso and Juarez. And the Juarez we see in the film, it's pretty seedy. I mean, there are scary people and there are prostitutes and there are criminals. And I know that you have friends and family in Juarez. Does it trouble you that that's the image Americans get?
It's a kind of a difficult issue because every city, even Paris, they have their own, you know, filthy little corners, their own little places where no one wants to walk on. And it's your choice to show this part or that or the part of any city. And yes, I have family and friends, and it's a city that I know very well because we have been there many times presenting plays and visiting my family and all that. And just like any other city in the world, we have our own problems. But Juarez is a wonderful city. It's a modern city.
You grew up in Mexico City in a whole family of actors. Is that right? Your parents were in the theater. Your brothers were actors, right? Did you always want to do
this? That is
correct. Yeah.
Well, my parents is a beautiful love, art, theater kind of story. They met each other studying theater in their hometown in Torreón, Mexico, up north, Mexico City. And they kind of rescued each other from their own families because no one knew what theater was. And then they moved to Mexico City and my brothers and I were born. And we became actors as well. But I was the only one in the family who wanted to be a soccer player. I wanted to be something else. I was doing already professional theater ever since I was a kid. But, you know, it was like a hobby for me. I just wanted to really become a professional soccer player. And then one day I invited my coach in one of the opening nights of a play that I was doing in Mexico City. And the next time he was overwhelmed by, you know, seeing all the stars and everyone, you know, coming to my dressing room and saying how much they enjoy my work and da-da-da-da-da. And then the next time we saw each other in a training day, he called me out from the group and he said, you know, it was great to see you on the stage. I wanted to ask you, do you know who Pelé was? I said, are you kidding me? Pelé? Everyone knows who Pelé was. At that point, Maradona didn't even exist. So it was all about Pelé. And I said, you know, he didn't really have any other choice in life, and you're a really good actor. So it was a really nice way to tell me that I wasn't talented enough to play soccer. I heard him. I was, I think, 14, 15. And from that point on, I only concentrated my whole energy and everything I wanted to do on theater.
And then at the age of 22, you moved to New York, is that right?
That's correct. My mom calls me pata de perro. Pata de perro it's something like, you know, we call pata de perro because there are a lot of lonely dogs wandering the streets in Mexico. You don't see that here. I haven't. But perro callejero, pata de perro, someone that is always, you know, on the streets and wandering around. And I could never stand still. So my mom used to call me pata de perro. You can never stay, you know, quiet. And I always wanted to move. And I remember when I was a member of the National Theater Company in Mexico, I was already looking for a chance and a time to go and immigrate and leave. And I did a film with the late fantastic Raul Julia called The Penitent in Mexico City. And I met my former girlfriend. We fell in love in San Miguel de Allende. And then she was living in New York, and I said, perfect, let's go. And that's when I left everything else behind. And everyone around me thought I was crazy, that what are you going to do there? You have your place here. You have your name here. I'll say, I know. I just have to get out there and try to find something.
Did you speak English?
Not at all. That was one of the things that I wanted to do, because I went to public school, and all you learn there is the pencil is red, the window is open, good morning, good afternoon. And God bless you. Good luck with the world. So I thought I knew some English, but when I arrived in New York, I remember the first time I wanted to go and apply for a job. I just looked at the newspaper, at the job section, and I found this ice cream store, and I thought that this is perfect because I'm gonna be able to eat ice cream, and then, you know, learn the flavors, and that's gonna be a good first lesson. But I couldn't even apply for a job because I didn't understand anything. When the manager talked to me, it was like Chinese for me. I could not understand a word. And then, you know, I took many different courses in New York. I'm still trying and struggling. You know, to learn a language when you're an adult, that's really very, very difficult. But I did. And I never thought I would be acting in English.
One of the roles that you really have become well known for is a long appearance on the Showtime series Weeds, which, of course, stars Mary Louise Parker. She's a middle-class single mom in San Diego named Nancy Botwin, who has supplemented her income by becoming a marijuana dealer and gotten really deeply into it. You play a drug lord and politician, mayor of Tijuana, I think, that she becomes associated with and then eventually romantically involved with. And this is a moment kind of early in their association where she's had a dispute with one of your lieutenants, a guy named Guillermo, played by Guillermo Diaz. You have summoned them to your office where you've been served a nice lunch. They don't get any. They're just sitting in front of you. And then you proceed to reprimand Guillermo. Let's listen.
Entonces, Guillermo, last week, Nancy received a portion of your shipment. What about?
Si.
I instructed you to give her that portion, and you did.
Si.
You gave her that portion, and then, from what I hear, you announced that you would kill the Marimacha bitch in front of her children. But I didn't instruct you to do that, did I? No, I did not. Now, Guillermo, you know I don't like to micromanage. I work with people who do their jobs well, and I leave them to do it. However, slaughtering a co-worker in front of witnesses, no less, has to be cleared with upper management. And your request is denied. Julio just doesn't travel well. You know, in the restaurant, this is delicious. Entonces, Guillermo, nothing bad is going to happen to Nancy, right?
Of course not.
I'm glad to hear that. I will increase your commission for shipments. You should live to enjoy your money.
Gracias.
Good. Everyone's friends again. You may go.
And that is our guest, Damian Bichir, in the Showtime series Weeds. This guy's very funny. You want to tell us about your character here, Esteban?
Esteban Reyes. We could have probably go into all the cliches about kingpins and this and that. But then I was lucky enough to have my writers on my side. And we wanted to make this guy a very sophisticated man, well-educated, conocedor de vinos, great wine connoisseur, opera lover, music lover, And he was clean cut. He would never be tacky or anything. He was elegant, dressing impeccably, and we wanted to contrast that with all the things that he would move under the table between Tijuana and San Diego. And I was really, really lucky because the first thing that I got here who opened that oyster was Mary Verneuil, a fantastic casting director, who proposed my name to Steven Soderbergh to play Fidel Castro on the Che films. And then we went to Puerto Rico and shot those films. And then I got this character when I was ready to go to Cannes, to the Cannes Film Festival, to present the Che films. So it was a very interesting, crucial time in my life because those two things were coming along together, Weeds and Che.
You got an Oscar nomination for Best Actor for the film A Better Life, directed by Chris Weitz. It's a really powerful film where you play, a landscaper, a gardener, an immigrant, you know, without an undocumented immigrant working in Los Angeles, single dad, has a teenage son. You want to tell us how you prepared for that role?
Let me go back a little bit because when I met Chris Weitz, he had invited me to audition for New Moon, one of the sequels for the vampire films. Mm-hmm. And I was very excited about, you know, playing a vampire. But basically, I wanted to meet Chris Weitz. And I remember when I got there, we began talking about this character. And he says, well, you know, it's really great. It's a gardener that, you know, he's working very hard to give his son a better life and this and that. And then I was a little bit confused because I didn't know if he was a vampire gardener.
Oh, he was mixing the two roles.
Yeah. And then, there were two different projects. And he told me, I wanted to talk to you about this also. You know, this is a project that we've been working on. We don't have a script ready, but when we have it, can I send it over to you? And I said, please, I beg you, please send it over. And a year later, he sent it over. I read it, and as soon as I finished it, in one shot, by the way, I called him immediately, and I told him, just please tell me what I have to do to fight for this role.
Well, I thought we'd listen to a clip from the film. This is when you, as the character Carlos Galindo, you're a gardener and a single parent. You have a 14-year-old son who you're worried about. You know, you're trying to make a better life for him. And this is a moment in the film where I won't give away all the details because folks may want to see it, but some important and unwelcome changes are coming in your life and his. And you're sitting down having a serious talk about yourself and your life. And he has asked you why, given all the hardships you and your ex-wife had him in the first place. And this is part of what you say.
You know, back in the village, you just did what any man would do. Found a novia. Get married, and then you'd head north. And that's what I did, because I didn't know any different. So we came here, and then we had you. Why? Because your mother and I loved each other very much. But then people change. And things were different here. Your mother changed. She wanted more than I could give her. So she went away. And I was left alone with you. I didn't know how I was going to manage with a small boy with no money and no regular job. I had a lot of anger inside me. But the thing, the one thing that helped me get over all that it was you, to be able to take care of you and watch you grow. Because I love you. You are the most important thing in this world to me, mijo.
I wanted you to be able to be anything you wanted to be. That would make me feel worthy.
And that's our guest, Demian Bichir, from the film A Better Life. That performance earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. You know, when I look at some of the roles that you've had, I mean, you've played cops a lot. You've played, you know, you played the drug dealer in Weeds, and you've played a lawyer for a drug dealer in Savages. And then, of course, you play the immigrant gardener in A Better Life. But I'm guessing that when you were in Mexico, you may have had a much wider variety of roles. And for the American audience who's seen you in a more limited way, is there a film in Mexico that we should look up that would give us a kind of a different sense of Demian Bichir?
You know, Dave, this is really interesting because it's the first time I'm realizing that I've had more variety in the roles that I play than ever before in my life. Being in Mexico, I was always playing a Mexican cop or a Mexican this or a Mexican that. But now here, I've been playing Cuban, I've been playing Fidel Castro, I've been playing all kinds of nationalities. Mm. I just did a film in the south of France in London with Jude Law, and I play a Russian. But there are many, many interesting films that some curious people could look at. I did a film with Penelope Cruz and Victoria Abril, one of the best Spanish actors ever, called Don't Tempt Me. Sin Noticias de Dios is the title in Spanish. And then there is Hasta Morir or Hidalgo, the story never told before. This is about the father of Mexican independence. And Fuera del Cielo, a lot of those films, they're everywhere, like Netflix or iTunes. And it's really easy to jump and take a look at them.
Demian Bichir co-stars in the FX series The Bridge. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies on our website, freshair.npr.org.